This is WJBC This Week.
It's supposed to measure college and career readiness, but there's no evidence to prove that. And it's just a waste of money and a waste of time.
What we have is somebody who, while committing a DUI, sped through the community, blew through traffic control signals, and hit Lauren Loeffler and Nicholas Jefferson and killed Ms. Loeffler.
This is not a surprise to any of us in the business. We knew that we were going to approach this cliff, and now it's time to think about what we want to do about it.
I believe the public, too, will support an increase if they have the faith and confidence that the elected officials will not raid that particular fund.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Starr. On this week's program, Bloomington floats the idea of closing Highland Park Golf Course, citing a drop in popularity for the game. We'll get reaction from Bloomington Golf Superintendent Jason Wingate. An Abraham Lincoln historian reflects on the 150th anniversary of his funeral. We'll talk to a political reporter who covered Dan Walker's rise to power and fall from it days following the former governor's death. Plus, we'll hear from a woman who fell in love with a man whom she helped get out of prison for a murder he didn't commit. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Bloomington's oldest golf course came under close scrutiny this week when City Manager David Hales suggested the city might have one golf course too many. Highland Park is the least profitable of the city's three golf courses, and he suggests there might be better uses for the property along Veterans Parkway and South Main Street. He talked with the WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
Is the city, as it prepares the next fiscal year budget, is the staff going to look at possibly closing Highland? Because I know that is at least one... new city council member said that should be considered.
Certainly I will recommend that the council do at least look at the feasibility of whether or not we should continue to keep Highland Golf Course open for the long run. But in doing so, we've also got to look at, well, can the other two remaining golf courses continue to meet the demand for golf in this community? And if Highland was to be looked at for an alternative use, what would that use be? And could it accommodate possibly retail, mixed use, things of that? But we're just at a very early stage. And, you know, this is one of our oldest. It does have some challenges in the terrain, but I think it is definitely something I would recommend the council look at, and let's do some analysis to help answer some of those questions.
We just had a story on the air yesterday from National, from our CBS radio network, saying that overall, nationwide, golfing is down, and that millennials especially, and it's all about millennials now, want to play nine holes, or they want to be done in an hour and a half, that the 18-hole golf course is going to be a thing of the past.
Yeah, well, we ought to ask our resident pro here. But, yeah, that's what we're seeing, too. Rounds of golfs are down. We've experienced that in Bloomington. And so part of that equation is there enough demand for three golf courses? Now, certainly Highland does have its own niche. A lot of people learning to golf, or a lot of the high school golf teams will come and utilize Highland. It's a little cheaper for them, but it does have some challenging terrain. And I think before we kind of rush into any sort of decision, it's imperative that we do look at, you know, what is the future of golf?
Well, tee times will become a premium.
Could you reduce Highland to a nine-hole course and maybe sell off half of it?
That's certainly what we would look at. And that's certainly one of those alternatives is could you split it up and maybe have nine holes on one, some retail fronting Veterans Parkway on the other. So, yes, I think that is definitely one of those options we would look at.
Because that's prime real estate.
Oh, it is. It is. And, yeah, hence, and frankly, you know, when you look at South Veterans Parkway, we need some sort of significant economic development, game changer or very significant catalyst to help get more businesses down at that area. Right now, they're so concentrated to the north, Veterans, or in the middle. You know, in my mind, we could have a great opportunity to kind of incentivize additional retail development down along the South Veterans Corridor if we do something right and, you know, that would really attract
May
other
I recommend
businesses.
A Hy-Vee South and a Chipotle. A Chipotle.
Yes.
Or not a Chipotle. What's the
Portillo's. Portillo's is what everybody wants. And they were at one time, according to a former city manager, wanting Veterans Parkway frontage.
Well, we've got some available here. All right. I want to go back to golf, too. Why the $500,000? I mean, was it due to weather? Were the rounds down? Have you looked into why they were $500,000 in
the
hole?
Why last summer was so?
Was it a terrible, you know, I drove by Highland Saturday. It's pouring down rain. It was one of those all-day rains. And that's got to kill the golf courses because there are only so many Saturdays you can play. You're not playing golf year-round here.
Yeah.
So to have a whole day washed out has to be a big blow.
It is. And, you know, just like as you say, we've got a lot of golf courses around this area. And whether it's weather, whether it's, you know, just the fact that rounds are below it. And I think it's important to point out our operating expenditures came in, you know, at or below budget, but it's the revenues that didn't keep up with those budgeted expenditures.
Right.
So, you know, if this trend continues, we've seriously got to look at, you know, are we going to gear up for even more subsidies to the golf fund, or is it really time to look at some alternative to avoid having to assist them with operating expenditures.
Or that retail on veterans, you think about the rent you could get, and then you think about the property tax, sales tax revenue you could get.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah. But, you know, once again, we need to have kind of that community conversation.
That was Bloomington City Manager David Hales with Scott and Colleen. We also got Bloomington Golf Superintendent Jason Wingate's reaction to the idea of closing Highland Park. What involvement or what discussion have you had with city officials on this at this point?
Up to this point, it's been something that has been discussed, looking at Highland Park and its current need for a subsidy at the course. But we keep coming back to the fact that that we certainly at the city value Highland Park and its rich history. The course has been here for almost 100 years, and with that comes a lot of you know, sentimental value and people in the community that love the course and grew up playing there. And our understanding is that looking at Highland Park is just one of the you know, many different ideas the city will be discussing this fiscal year to try to help balance the budget. So, you know, we encourage those who value Highland Park to share their support and ideas with their aldermen.
Of the three, why is Highland Park being targeted, so to speak, do you think?
Highland Park is a course that, in today's standards, is a it doesn't really meet modern golf courses. It's a little bit shorter. The course does receive the largest subsidy across all three courses, and you know, currently it does have some needs there as far as capital needs that are increasing, and I think that's probably why it's being looked at right now.
One of the ideas that's been tossed around, and David Hales, the city manager, addressed this today, possibility of converting it to a nine-hole course, seeming to indicate that there's a trend in golf that way, that millennials in particular are looking for, you know, nine-hole courses, spending less time and still get around in.
That's correct. We have not explored at a sufficient length converting it to a nine-hole course or anything like that. But I can tell you that the course staff are actively pursuing a make time for nine campaign where we're going to be looking to get people out to play just nine holes. As you mentioned, it is tough for people to get out anymore for 18 holes, you know, to give up a half a day. So a nine-hole, you know, rates that we offer will be promoted. But as far as you know, exploring turning it into a nine-hole course, those haven't been discussed at any sort of a sufficient length to determine their effectiveness to reduce the subsidy level.
This has been sort of a trend across the country, though, right, in terms of participation?
Oh, without a doubt. Nationwide, unfortunately, the golf industry has seen a slow and steady decline for really about the last 10 years. You know, work and family requirements have really kind of impacted the casual golfer's ability, you know, to give up a day or really a half day to get out and play. So the golf industry right now is trying to look into new ways to get people to come out to play. And That's with this new Make Time for Nine campaign. Also at Highland Park, we'll be looking to add foot golf down there for this year to, you know, bring alternative uses to the property with hopes to get more activity and, you know, more revenue that will follow with that activity.
If, as discussions go, the city decides that Highland Park should be cut to save money, and they would probably extrapolate that the golfers at Highland Park would just go to the Den, they go to Prairie Vista, they'd find another course in the city. Is that the case, or would some, or would the city lose that revenue and lose those golfers altogether?
I don't know that we could, you know, plan on all those golfers, you know, making their way to the other two golf courses. Highland Park, its place in the community is affordable recreation. It does have the lowest greens fees in our community, and I think the people that play there are looking for a value. And I'm not sure that, you know, that they would absolutely make their way to our other two courses. So I'm not sure, you know, where they would go, but I would be hesitant to say that they would all make their way to our other two courses.
So it sounds like you could make a case that the cost savings that they are projecting is not reality, or at least not all of it.
Well, like I said, I would hate to make a comment on that right now, but yeah, I'm not so sure that we could say, well, all of those rounds of golf would automatically work their way to the other courses, and that would, you know, that would solve everything. So it certainly be something we would look at in the situation, though.
That was Bloomington Golf Superintendent Jason Wingate. Dan Walker, a man who never walked away from a political brawl, but lost far more than he won. That's how Scott Reeder describes the former governor, who served one term and later served 18 months in prison for bank fraud. Walker died this week at the age of 92. Reeder, now the executive editor of the Illinois News Network, talked with WJBC's Terry James this week, where he recalled an in-person interview he had with Walker in 2002.
You traveled to San Diego to interview former Illinois Governor Dan Walker, who passed away just recently, and it said at that point you two had stayed in touch. In touch with the governor up to his death?
Oh, it's been a while since I talked to him last, but yeah, after I went out to San Diego, he would call me occasionally, and I'd call him, and you know, I interviewed him for a few more stories over the years. Very interesting guy, very enigmatic figure. In a lot of ways, but yeah, fascinating individual. I mean, kind of his life is kind of like almost like a Greek tragedy at times, you know, rising up to the absolute heights and then going down to the bottom of despair. I mean, just kind of the whole gamut.
And at the time when you wrote this, and let's remind people that Governor Walker did not serve prison time for anything that happened while he was governor. Is actually something from his banking career 10 years later. Bank fraud charges were filed. Mm-hmm. He served a year and a half in prison. But at the time you wrote this, we were learning about George Ryan waiting for his sentencing. And, you know, I imagine you felt it was time to look back on the former governor going to prison.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When I first went out and talked to Dan Walker back in, I think it was 2002, you know, we sat and we talked about Illinois politics, I mean, all these things. And then when we came up to the topic of of him going to prison, he just got real teary-eyed and just said, I'm just not going to talk about that. I just can't talk about it. And then a couple years later, we talked on the phone, and he was very open about what had happened to him there. He said that he was repeatedly subjected to body cavity searches by guards who were with really the intent of humiliating him. So, you know, at the time he was a 65-year-old former corporate executive and governor in prison, and they're searching him, giving him rectal searches for drugs. And he said, what do they think? I'm a very likely person to be smuggling drugs in a prison. I mean, he felt that way. He had been originally given a job as an assistant to the chaplain at the prison. A new warden was assigned to the prison, who actually is a West Pointer, and of course Walker was an Annapolis grad, and he kind of took an instant dislike to Walker made him stop wearing his Annapolis ring in prison, but he also he fired him from his chapel job and gave him a stick with a nail on the end of it and told him, I want you to spend your days walking the prison yard, picking up cigarette butts and trash all day long and putting it in a tin can. And I don't care, this is in Duluth, Minnesota, he said, I don't care if it's below zero, that's what you're going to be doing. And then he had burned into the stick, governor's stick, and he says to him, and whenever I have a visitor coming to my office here at the prison, I'm going to look out the window and point you out and say, there's a former governor.
Wow.
But yeah, he had a real rough time of it in the federal prison.
He said he was utterly humiliated and he was stared at, and he felt that the guards were out to get him, basically. Is that correct?
Well, that's the story, what he shared with me. I mean, obviously, I can't talk to the guards who were involved, but it sounds like he had a really, really rough time, more so than a lot of inmates in that prison, because of his former status as a governor. But I'd also be remiss in not noting, I mean, Walker was an incredibly brilliant man. He had a lot of fine characteristics, I mean, but there was also a level of vanity there. I mean, in my first meeting with him, he managed to work into the conversation. I have an IQ of 172. I mentioned that he'd clerked for the Chief Justice of the United States, Fred Vinson. And then he adds, he was a very nice man, but not brilliant. And I'm thinking, so this is also a man who could be incredibly arrogant. And I have a feeling that arrogance probably shined through at the prison and didn't sit well with a lot of the staff, and he might have brought some of these problems upon himself. Not that anyone deserves to get that kind of treatment. I'm just saying he was a very complex individual.
He could not talk about his time in prison really before this. I mean,
no.
He would break down in tears if he was asked to talk about it.
Which was very unsettling, because this is such a proud man. He had a very distinguished career before he went into politics. He was the chief corporate counsel for Montgomery Ward's. He was a partner in one of the top law firms in Chicago. He graduated second in his class from Northwestern Law School. He was proudest, he said, of the fact that he was able to get admitted to Annapolis during World War II when he was just an ordinary seaman. And he passed a test, did so well on a test that he was, out of all the sailors in the Navy, was one of the handful that were allowed to be admitted as an enlisted man into the Naval Academy. So, I mean, he had incredible accomplishments in his life. I mean, not to mention he was married for, I think I've read anywhere from 25 to 30 years, with seven kids. I mean, he had a lot of things that he could rightly be very proud of.
One takeaway from your story with him had to do with the fact that our view of minimum security prisons, which he was in, is that, you know, there's arts and crafts time and you play golf and watch TV, and that's not the case.
That's no, and you know, the old joke is the only bar that you'll find in a federal minimum security prison is the salad bar. I mean, so yeah, he had a rough go of it. If I remember right, I think he witnessed one inmate assaulting another inmate. He also said the inmates had a rough time with them. One of the interesting things about Walker was, back in the 60s and the early 70s, one of the things that he kind of made a name for himself is going after organized crime. I mean, he was part of the Chicago Crime Commission, and he really spotlighted people who he thought were in cahoots with the mob or were part of the mafia, all these things. But he had an excellent civil rights record. He really, during that era of Martin Luther King and others, he was really had a great record as far as working with the black community and working for civil rights. When he got into the prison, he faced some incredibly hostel of black inmates and sought protection. And the who he ended up seeking protection from was a convicted Philadelphia police officer who had been in cahoots with the mob. And it was kind of fascinating. You know, he kind of life flipped on him. I mean, once this champion of civil rights is now finding himself on the opposite end of the situation. I mean, he was just an interesting guy.
That was Scott Reeder of the Illinois News Network with our Terry James reflecting on the life of former Governor Dan Walker. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. This weekend marks an anniversary of one of the saddest times in Bloomington Normal history as the train transporting the body of Abraham Lincoln passed through town on its way to the 16th president's hometown of Springfield for burial. Local Lincoln author and historian Guy Fraker reflects on that dark time with WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds.
It would be this Sunday that Lincoln came through on the train?
Yeah, May 3rd was the time. And it's sort of a neat local story. The train came from Chicago starting before midnight. The Pantograph had publicized that it was going to be here at 5 in the morning on May 1st. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, all the bells in town on the churches started chiming to wake people up to go down to the train station, which at that time was at the west end of Chestnut. And so 5,000 people was the estimate that showed up. The city's population was 8,000. And 5,000 people showed up for nothing more than the train essentially coming through.
It didn't stop.
Didn't stop. It may have stopped to take on water. I'm not sure about that, but there was no formal stop. There's a timetable that I brought along with me just to sort of illustrate the times that was published as to the route of the train as it came down. It was supposed to get in here a little like 4:30, and it didn't arrive till about 5, but there were that many people there.
That is unbelievable when you think about that.
Isn't it? I think it is, too.
And so what do you think that means? I mean, he was revered.
Hold on.
Right?
Can I stop a second? Do we know what the weather was like that day?
No, I don't.
Because I've heard many times the biggest determining factor of how many people show up for your funeral is the weather that day.
I'm getting close enough that
he was more of an important man. I think we would have shown. I certainly would have.
No, let me tell you what people don't appreciate as much is how close Bloomington was to him. We all think of Springfield being his base of operations, which, of course, it was. It was his home. But he had no real supporters down there in Springfield. His base of support, his closest support, was, of course, led by David Davis, was here in Bloomington. So I think Bloomington was pretty rocked by this in a personal way. And the Pantograph had a wonderful statement at the time of his death about losing kind of one of our own. So I think it was more than merely the President of the United States and so forth. It was one of their own coming home.
So we have some communities in central Illinois commemorating this with various things. Tell us about what is planned right now.
Okay. Lincoln College had their event on the 20th of April, not to compete with Springfield, which is going to be the main focus. But Lincoln College has a new museum that I've maybe mentioned on here before that's just marvelous, their Lincoln Heritage Museum, and it's dedicated to the funeral. So that display is worth driving that short distance down to see that. Here in town, the only thing I know of is Vaughn Hoffman at Wesley United Methodist is giving a sermon on Lincoln's funeral. And they've asked me to say a few things after the service in their hour that they usually devote to more spiritual things. So, but that I know of. But then as you go down the tracks, the big day in Springfield is the 2nd of May. And then again on the 3rd of May.
Yeah. Isn't the 4th the day?
The 4th is the day.
But
yeah, there again, I'm a purist, you know. And the fourth is the day of, this is 150 years, of course. Why not have it on the 150th day? And the thought was people wouldn't come because of work and so forth. So
we
they could moved
have made it a state holiday.
Yeah, actually.
I don't know. Yeah, so a lot of the ceremonies this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, down in Springfield.
In Springfield, yes. I'm speaking down there. The main speaker, I should mention first, of course, is Edna Greene Medford, this marvelous African-American historian from Howard, who's talking about what Lincoln means to us now and in the future. Her talk's at 1:45, and then at the Lincoln Museum. And then I'm speaking at the Grace Lutheran Church about the funeral train itself, and it's this very soulful run from Chicago to Springfield.
So did the train race through that? How fast were they going at the time? Certainly not, you know.
No, it was very slow.
It was just a slow.
It was very slow. And this timetable that I have outlines the procedure. All the telegraph, I suppose, fearing some mishap. There's a pilot engine that went 20 minutes ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And all the telegraph stations had to stay open. And remember, this is in the middle of the night. All the stations had to be open. And they would signal the train as it went by, the pilot engine, as it went by, as to whether it was okay to proceed. Just, I suppose, hoping there'd be nothing, no incident, which there was not, of course.
All right.
There are a lot of events going on, though, in Springfield, you know, really starting today. And you gave us a kind of a nice list, and there might be some things even over the weekend that people might want to make a trip.
Oh, I'd recommend
to Springfield
it. I would recommend it. Yeah, I'm making a little light of the changing of the day, but that doesn't change the fact that they are reenacting the funeral, and it should be quite moving. I've spoken a few times, including last night or yesterday noon to the symphony luncheon, and I was surprised how emotional I was talking about it. So, one woman came up to me, and this is the highest compliment I could have been paid, and she said, "You ruined my makeup today."
Oh, wow.
But I should mention that here. The May 1st is the symphony. The Illinois Symphony is performing.
That's
marvelous
Friday
program.
Night.
Yeah, Friday night. They're doing it in Springfield, of course, as they usually do on Saturday. But here, and it's John Henry, Copeland's John Henry. So it relates to the railroad and the funeral. They're doing a medley from Porgy and Bess, honoring Lincoln's recognition of African American humanity, and then the central piece is this marvelous by Earl Robinson song or piece, Lincoln's Funeral Train.
That was Lincoln historian Guy Fraker with our Scott and Colleen. Joyce King was working for the Innocence Project when she fell in love with a man she would eventually help free. James Woodard served 27 years in prison for murder before DNA evidence cleared him. But Woodard's troubles never went away. And King shared her story with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
He wanted to know if I would help him write a book. He told me that in prison he had read my first book, Hate Crime, about the Jasper case. And from there we started talking every time we saw each other. He would do whatever he could to get me to come to his apartment. One thing led to another, and we just found that we were very connected, and we had a lot of destiny connecting us, and I just fell for him. I really did.
When he was released from prison, what was that transition like for him? Did he have people helping him with the transition? Did he have family? It seems like he was ready to get on with his life from the way that you describe his interaction with you.
He was ready to get on with his life. Unfortunately, 27 years in Texas prison had institutionalized James in a way that he was not even aware of. And I saw up close and personal nightmares. He had a lot of prison demons that he dealt with. And I think there was a great deal of frustration. In fact, I know there was, for just dealing with everyday simple things we take for granted. A lot of these men have been gone 2 and 3 decades. And cell phones, internet, all technology is just completely baffling for them. It takes a while to transition. And I had the kind of patience that I could, you know, give to James and share with him and be with him. But it seems all around us he was rushed by the rest of the world. Hurry up and get acclimated. Hurry up and learn how to do this. And he had not learned how to move quite that quickly, mentally, physically, emotionally. He was 27 years old when he was arrested. He was 55 years old when we got him out.
In some ways, parolees have an advantage over the exonerated when it comes to that transition back to life outside prison. Somebody is checking in on parolees. They have to check in themselves. There are benchmarks they have to reach. But this is not so with the exonerated.
That's absolutely right. If you are guilty and you are paroled, you have a parole officer, you qualify for programs that the state is helping you with. You can enroll in computer classes. You qualify for church programs because you are paroled. But the innocent, initially, they did not have anything like that to fall back on because this work is essentially, innocence work is so new. So a lot of them band together, they form groups to, and in Texas there are a lot of them to band together. So they actually have to help each other get along. You asked about family a second ago. Sadly, James only had a half-sister, and they literally did not know each other. They were strangers, and it was a very strange relationship. His mother died while he was in prison. I worked with about 12 exonerees during my time with the Innocence Project, and I remember one who spent 20 years in prison. When he got out, 10 of his family members had died while he was incarcerated. So it literally is, where are we going to go? Who's going to help us? And I just saw a story about two North Carolina exonerees, the two brothers who were exonerated after 30 years. One of them was on death row the whole time. And they have to wait on a pardon from the governor to even be eligible for compensation. So I'm happy to say that in Texas, we do have a pretty good compensation law. It doesn't make the exonerees wait forever to file their compensation. And we try to make sure they get the money very quickly so they can have a place to live, so that they can get psychological counseling and help and everything that they need to get them started.
Now, are there any rules in place that say that the exonerees have to go through counseling? Are there any steps at all that they have to go through to ease in that transition?
No, there aren't any fast, hard rules that say they have to, but we do have programs that finally have been put in place by wonderful volunteers and workers who just really, really admire the exonerees and what they've gone through. They do get a lot of help, as I say, here in Texas from other exonerees who counsel them on what it was like for them when they were exonerated, say, 10 years ago, 5 years ago. So they do get help from their fellow exonerees. But as far as there being a mandatory, you must go to financial counseling. You must go to psychological evaluation. No, it is not mandatory. I only wish that it was after what I saw with James and after what happened to James and how he was taken from me.
James was in a cell, unfortunately, when he passed away. He died in 2012. He'd been out of prison for 4 years, but he was back in jail at the time he died. What happened?
James had a car crash, the 8th car crash in 4 years. I don't know anyone who could survive 8 car crashes in 4 years. He suffered from seizures. He should never drive, and he and I argued about that a lot. He had had a car accident. Police came to the scene of the accident, working it as that, but they discovered he had a small amount of a controlled substance on him. He was arrested for that and for outstanding warrants that they found. James was carried to jail, Dallas County Jail. He should have been able to bond out in a day or two, but instead he was left there for several weeks, which I have never understood from the lawyers completely. I was looking for James, did not know where he was, that he had been arrested, and I got a phone call that he died of a seizure on the floor of his Dallas County jail cell in October of 2012. James Woodard was 60 years old.
He had developed a lot of health problems that appeared, at least, while he was in prison. Do you think that he was, in a way, feeling like he was living on borrowed time with all of these issues? It seems like he, once he got the money at least, had kind of a self-destructive streak in him. Do you think he ever really truly transitioned out of being in prison?
I think mentally he did not. I think on the exterior, physically and somewhat emotionally, he was able to convince people with this facade that he was better than he was, but they did not know him privately or see what I saw. I think a lot of people thought James was doing a lot better after he got the compensation than he was. I tell readers in the book, I knew about the seizures. He had suffered seizures in prison for 20 years, but they were well managed by Dilantin. But once he got out, and we did run a lot of physicals and we did run a lot of psychological tests on him, we discovered James had high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, which I credited the prison diet probably for that, and he smoked about 2 packs a day. It often felt like I was living with a walking time bomb. And then the car crashes, there were a couple that were pretty severe. He nearly died. I just thought, James, you've used up all 9 of your lives. Stop, because I want you here with me. But he was on this destructive bend. It was almost like he was trying to make up for lost time, which we tell exonerees can never be done.
James Woodard's case was instrumental in helping make some changes in the system. There were things that were challenged that happened to him that were brought forth, and there were changes in the criminal justice system of the state of Texas. What are some of the things that James's case was used as an example of to change the rules?
I'm glad you asked me that, because I don't want his legacy to just be that he died on the floor of Dallas County Jail. James was much loved in this state and across the country for his personality and his willingness to work hard and to advocate. He, of course, was part of the contingent that persuaded lawmakers to pass the Timothy Cole Compensation Act. In 2011, he helped persuade lawmakers to pass the double-blind sequential law, which has to do with the way photo and live lineups are done. So I was very, very proud of him. In 2009, we went to New York. James helped 60 Minutes win a Murrow Award for a segment about him, and he was the only one to receive a standing ovation in the room that night. He was so humble and so learned. He knew he was making a lot of mistakes, but he also did a lot to inspire law students to choose criminal law, to choose to do innocence work, to choose to have a passion about helping the less fortunate, helping poor people who might not have a good defense. So James left a legacy of more than just, you know, a man who was on a rampage. He actually suffered a lot. And so we now also have the Michael Morton Law, which deals with prosecutorial misconduct. So Texas is trying to correct some of the injustices of the past.
That was the Innocence Project's Joyce King with our Steve Fast. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Uptown Normal was filled with the sounds of high school students marching in protest of the park exam this week. WJBC's Adam Stasinski was there.
The rally was organized by the Blono Student Union. Normal Community High School senior Lambert Lee says the 10-hour-plus test takes students out of the classroom when they could be learning.
It's supposed to measure college and career readiness, but there's no evidence to prove that. And it's just a waste of money and a waste of time.
Bloomington High School sophomore Alexandra Cordell says the test, which is primarily done online, causes funding issues for schools already struggling to find money. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
A woman convicted of aggravated DUI for the 2012 death of Lauren Loeffler has filed for executive clemency. Katie Lawson of Bloomington, currently serving a 12-year prison term. In her filing, she claims her medical condition can't be effectively treated in prison, a claim McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers disputes.
They petitioned to have her brought back here to the court again for an additional hearing after the sentencing hearing, and there was testimony that there's no reason this cannot be treated while she's serving out her sentence in DOC.
The governor will have a final say. A Bloomington woman going back to a mental health facility instead of standing trial on charges of calling in a fake bomb threat to a former employer. 60-year-old Teresa Shepherd appeared in court for the status of a bench trial, but both the prosecution and defense argued the trial should be delayed. The prosecution argued that Shepherd had relapsed after earlier mental health treatment and couldn't understand the charges against her. The Illinois Department of Transportation is listening to suggestions on how to improve the state's infrastructure in tough financial times.
in a meeting at Bloomington City Hall this week. City Manager David Hales says the only way to keep roads funded is to raise revenue.
And if that takes a constitutional amendment or something of that nature to ensure that, you know, the intent of the fee is not jeopardized, you know, then so be it. But there's got to be more revenue. And I believe the public, too, will support an increase if they have the faith and confidence that the elected officials will not raid that particular fund.
Heartland Community College has raised nearly $7.7 million in its American Dreams Local Results fundraising campaign. The money will go toward four specific goals, with one being scholarships. Campaign chairwoman Julie Dobsky explains the other three.
Pathway to Success, which supports all the key components of Heartland. Develop a program addressing the existing needs of our business in the community. And, of course, to institute a Challenger Learning Center fund to provide additional opportunities for our community.
Campaign exceeded its goal by nearly $400,000. And former Congressman Aaron Schock's whereabouts are a mystery after his recent resignation. An attorney for a campaign donor suing the Peoria Republican has told a federal judge he can't track down Schock. A Peoria address for Schock is said to be vacant, and no comment from a Schock spokesman. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, nursing home residents, family, and staff will be taking part in a protest to oppose Medicaid cuts in Illinois. On Tuesday, the Bloomington Normal YMCA will kick off its annual Strong Kids fundraising campaign. On Wednesday, a committee of Bloomington Public Library board members will discuss the library's bookmobile routes, which the mayor says don't include enough trips to the city's west side. On Thursday, the Bloomington Normal Convention and Visitors Bureau and Sports Commission host a Cruisin' with Lincoln luncheon on the Route 66 Visitor Center. And Friday, Downs holds its annual Civil War Days, which includes a battle reenactment and plenty of learning activities for students. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.